To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time, and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Welcome, hello, this is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And for all you guys out there, happy Father's Day. It is. Come around again. Today we celebrate Dad, the guy that went out and did the job. We didn't get to see him a lot because he was working hard enough to pay the bills when he was there. So I got to talk to my father. He's 94, 95 now. I'm losing track. I'm getting so old, I'm losing track of his age. I got a hold of him. He doesn't like communication. He doesn't have a phone in his assisted living facility. He can afford a phone. He just doesn't like to talk on the phone, and he feels it's an inconvenience to have a phone. So I have to go through hoops just to wish him a happy Father's Day. I said, well, Dad, it's all about me. He said, no, 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 it's all about me. And then we go back and forth. I'd like to acknowledge W-E-A-H, that's Hoy Carter and Tony the Horse, before I have the opportunity to broadcast live to the listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and sweet home, Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. In other words, they don't charge us because they believe in what we're doing. We believe in what we're doing, and we hope by the time you finish the program, you'll believe in what we're doing. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us a space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist, and he does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe the families basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, basically so does the world. And being Father's Day, I got something interesting I wanted to put out. But first of all, I wanted to say hello to Harold. Harold, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Joseph, and thank you for continuing to produce this program. Our efforts here are our way of giving back. Nobody makes a penny from this program or the website, rumradio.org. It's all dedicated to helping really foster recovery and healthy living. And the way to do that is working the 12 steps with a sponsor and eventually being a sponsor. That's really changed my life and saved my life, and so we're here to help you learn all about that and how to do that. We do have a phone number you can call in and be part of the program this evening. 949-534-0621. 949-534-0621. So call in and be part of it. Let me turn it back over to you, Joseph. What do you have for tonight?
Okay, Harold, I got a little different tinge. We have a guest. He's got long-term recovery we like to do, and he's going to be telling us a story. Kurt P., you there, Kurt?
I am, Joe. How are you?
Yeah, good. I go by Joseph. I'm good.
Joseph.
And happy Father's Day.
Same
I think that's
to you.
Always good to say. I had a friend of mine call me and wish me a happy Father's Day. I don't know, he's my barber. My barber called me. My kids didn't call me, but my barber called me to wish me a happy Father's Day. Well, my kids have issues, and a lot of us in recovery is the case. We were absentee dads. I was, anyway, and had issues. And my children just now, they're not children anymore. They'll always be my children, but these are grown adults now, and they have issues that can't seem to resolve. And you know what? Sometimes you just have to let people be who they're going to be. I have no control. I do the best I can, make my amends, and then I have to move on. So, but I love them, and I pray for them every night. So, hey, that's the way it goes sometimes. But before I turn it over to you, Kurt, to tell your story, something I got in church today I think might be a good. Harold, I think you're going to want some of the statistics, too. These are statistics. And you know what they say, figures don't lie, but liars figure. An old banker mentor friend of mine gave me that. 63% of youth suicides are from fatherless homes, five times the average. 90% of all homeless and runaway children are from fatherless homes, 30 times the average.
Wow.
85% of all children who show behavior disorders come from fatherless homes, 20 times the average. 80% of rapists with anger problems come from fatherless homes, 14 times the average. 71% of all high school dropouts come from fatherless homes, 9 times the average. Fatherless children are twice as likely to drop out of school. Children with fathers who are involved are 70% likely. What do you got? Children with fathers who are involved are 40% less likely to repeat a grade in school. Children with fathers who are involved are 70% less likely to drop out of school. Children with fathers who are involved are more likely to get A's in school. Children with fathers who are involved are more likely to enjoy school and engage in extracurricular activities. 75% of all adolescent patients in chemical abuse centers come from fatherless homes, 10 times the average. Father factor in drug and alcohol abuse. Researchers at Columbia University found that children in two-parent households with poor relationship with their fathers are 68% more likely to smoke, drink, or use drugs compared to all teens in two-parent households. Teens in a single mother household are at 30% higher risk than those in two-parent households. 70% of youths in state-operated institutions come from fatherless homes, 9 times the average. 85% of all youths in prison come from fatherless homes, 20 times the average. Incarceration, even after controlling for income, youth in father-absent households still had significantly higher odds of incarceration than those in mother-father families. In crime factors, 109 juvenile offenders indicated that family structure significantly predicts delinquency. Adolescents, particularly boys in single-parent families, are at higher risk of status, property, and personal delinquencies. Moreover, students attending schools with a high proportion of children of single parents are also at risk. A study of 13,986 women in prison showed that more than half grew up without their father. 42% grew up in single mother households, and 16% lived with neither parent. Compared to living with both parents, living in a single parent home doubles the risk that a child will suffer physical, emotional, or educational neglect. The overall rate of child abuse and neglect in a single-parent household is 27.3 children per thousand, whereas the rate of overall maltreatment in two-parent households is 15.5 per thousand. daughters of single parents without a father involved at 53% more likely to marry as teenagers, 711% more likely to have children as teenagers, 164% more likely to have premarital birth, and 92% more likely to get divorced themselves. Adolescent girls raised in a two-parent home with involved fathers are significantly less likely to be sexually active than girls raised without involved fathers. 43% of U.S. children are without their father. How's that, Harold, huh? 43%.
Wow.
90% of homeless and runaway children are from fatherless homes. 80% of rapists motivated with displaced anger come from fatherless homes. 71% of pregnant teenagers lack a father. 63% of youth suicides are from fatherless homes. 85% of children who exhibit behavioral disorders come from fatherless homes. 90% of adolescent repeat arsonists live with only their mother. 71% of high school dropouts come from fatherless homes. 75% of adolescent parents in chemical abuse centers come from fatherless homes. 70% of juveniles in state-operated institutions have no father. 85% of youths in prison grew up in fatherless homes. Fatherless boys and girls are twice as likely to drop out of high school, twice as likely to end up in jail, four times more likely to need help for emotional and behavioral problems. 64.3 million estimated number of fathers across the nation. 26.5 million number of fathers who are part of a married couple families with their own children under the age of 18. 22% are raising three or more of their own children under 18 age among married couples. 2% live in the household or relative of a non-relative, and the rest of it is kind of redundant. So what did you think of those numbers, Harold?
Well, it's no surprise, and I see it on a daily basis. The kids that I work with and the families that I try to help. So it's easy to get discouraged. Every week I meet people, men, who have been willing to step forward and love and nurture kids that are not biologically connected to them. And I explain to them that they are my heroes. We're in quite a pickle in our society right now, and I think it has a lot to do with absent fathers.
Yeah, thank you, Harold. I thought, being Father's Day, since I just heard that at church today, I had the fellow send me over the stats. And it's all verifiable information. This is all the numbers are there from credible government and social sources. So this is what's going on. This is we're developing a fatherless society, and this is the outlay. And, of course, drugs and alcohol are huge when it comes to the prisons, AA, NA, CA. Well, to get on with the program, I usually like to, so for the fathers out there that are doing the job, happy Father's Day. And for the fathers out there who are not doing the job, get on the stick, guys. You're either part of the problem or you're the part of the solution. Now, this is Rum Radio. We're not AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. And we're not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're more like Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you're a part of Narcoleptics Anonymous, you can consider this a wake-up call for your program of recovery. I like to start the show, we've been doing it lately, with how it works. And using the big book as the template, all 12-step programs, all, come from the basic understanding found in the text, the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous or the big book. It's So I like to use the big book when I'm doing that because that's the original understanding. Now, there's other fellowships, and they use a little different format, but basically all 12 steps come from this book. So on chapter 5, it's on page 58, third edition. I got my third edition. And that's where the name Rum Radio comes from. It's one of the stories in the third edition. I ransacked my book looking for something with some cachet that people in recovery would recognize. Everything that you would have recognized or things that you would have never recognized were either used or being taken. So when I went, I flipped back to the stories and I saw, Rum Radio and Rebellion. Rum Radio. I like that. It rings. Easy to remember. See if it's taken. Got it. Nobody had it. So there we go. Rum Radio. That's where the name comes from. Right out of the big book. And this is chapter 5, How It Works. This is read most often, but not always, and I'm surprised when it's not, in every recovery meeting in AA. Now, the other groups do other things, and each group is autonomous, and that's the way it's set up. We don't have a central. We have the GSO, General Service Organization, but they do not direct the activities of the group. They facilitate some of the things we do, but each group is autonomous as long as it doesn't affect AA as a whole or other groups. Otherwise, it's whatever the group conscience, and a group conscience is the group as the people in that community, in that particular group, the collective personalities of that group, birds of a feather kind of deal. Well, they flock together and they make decisions, and those decisions are binding to some degree on the group's direction and position. So you go from one place to another, and there's a common thread, but usually the formats are just all over the place. So you're never going to get to they usually mimic each other in the regions, but they get far afield in some areas. They stay closer to understandings in other areas, so it's kind of a grab bag. But this is when it's read. This is how it's read. It's how it works. And it's rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. So those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to be born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're all like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. But there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood them. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
If he were sought, yes.
You know, that's interesting with the three propositions. I think that's at steps one, two, and three right there. That's the way I see it. And that God could and would if he were sought, that happened, I guess, maybe about 8-9 years ago. It just seemed like it just popped up out of nowhere, and everybody was doing it at the same time. It was the strangest phenomenon because I had been moved from Austin. They weren't doing it. When I got to Houston, they weren't doing it. And then all of a sudden, it just seemed like it popped up. Like, where'd it come from? And I think that was God doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. But anyway, so I'm excited about the story tonight. I think it's going to be a good story. This guy's got a good program. He's a big book thumper. That's what we call people who rely on the basic text to work a solid recovery program. Remember, the meetings will keep you sober, but if you're not working the steps as outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you might be sober, but you're not in recovery. So, Kurt, tell us what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now.
All right, Joe. Joseph, first off, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure. We've been kind of talking about this for a couple of years, actually, and, you know, one thing leads to another, and you're talking about God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. You know, it just seemed like it was the right time, and you had a need for me tonight, and I was planning I'd do it in at another time, and that's okay. So here I am. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Yeah, by the way, it was a last-minute deal with Kurt, and he was gracious enough to come on. The previous scheduled host, I believe she got cold feet. It happens from time to time. The romance of the radio, and Kurt was gracious enough. You know, we have a placard on the wall. You know, Harold, what's that placard say, the one that you're mad that they grabbed down at Lamplighters? Anytime?
Well, when it states that when anyone reaches out, we have a responsibility to reach back. And that poster got removed from my favorite meeting, and they mentioned that they were painting the walls, but the poster never got put back up.
I see
less 12-step work done.
That's the I am responsible clause, right?
Yes, I'm responsible any time.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Thank you.
It was rad, our stories were disclosed in a general way, what it used to be like, what it's like, what happened, what it's like now. Not to talk about something that will dispel any of those numbers that you rolled out there about the fatherless homes, but I was one that grew up in a normal family, as normal as a family could be. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, upstate New York, hometown of IBM and Endicott Johnson Shoes. It was boom time. Things were good. You know, everybody at least had one car in the garage and maybe a picket fence and a cat and a dog and everything. You know, it was kind of leave it to Beaver kind of stuff, really, to be honest with you. At least that was the way I saw it. Although, at the same time, I was the type of person that didn't quite seem to, in certain group settings, didn't quite seem to fit in. And so I was, you know, I would learn later on that behavior was counterproductive to my, you know, sober type of lifestyle.
Sure.
Which,
well, let's back
you
up.
Know,
let's back up a little bit, Kurt. When was the first time the drugs and alcohol rang your bell? How old were you?
You know, that's a good question. I was probably about 5 or 6 or maybe even 7. I had a couple of uncles that when they came over for any kind of event at the house or holidays or we were at their house, they would always, you know, leave a little in, you know, and go ahead and have a sip. It's okay. And it was kind of cool and it was kind of funny. And go get me another beer and go get me another drink. So I was drinking, you know, a little bit of their drink. And I can remember kind of sort of even to today, kind of vividly, you know, going into the kitchen and drinking, you know, one of my Uncle George's, you know, the last remnants of his highball, as he used to call it, and having this, what I would learn later on was this, this feeling that came on because of that. It was this sense of ease and comfort that came at once. And so, you know, I didn't drink alcoholically at 6 or 7 years old, but, you know, I probably wanted to. If that answers your question.
So 5 or 6, okay, yeah, okay, I get it. So you knew something was up the first time you drank. You know, you liked
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Like, and the first time I drank freely, you know, we're going to move ahead a little bit. I was probably about 14 and a half. I went to a birthday party of a guy I worked with who was a year ahead of me in high school, and it was kind of sort of his birthday and graduation party at the same time. And showed up there not even thinking anything about it. You know, we're going to have a cookout. We're going to have some, you know, some food and come on over. And I walked around the back of the house and had a bunch of picnic tables set up, and his mother, who I had never met before, she didn't know me from Adam. She knew me from the neighborhood, but I'd never met her before. And she says, would you like a beer? And I looked at her, and I thought, lady, you clearly don't know how old I am. But I was like, that's a good thing. Yeah, sure. And I drank about, I think I drank like 5 and a half Budweiser in the bottles in about probably 45 minutes to an hour. And I was immediately transformed into the life of the party. I was the hippest, slickest, and coolest guy at the party. I was funny. If we were dancing, I could have danced really well. You know, everything was going, it was like I had arrived. There's a part in the big book where Bill Wilson tells the story that I had arrived, you know. So, you know, I had arrived, and it was on. And but within 15 minutes after drinking maybe the half of the fifth bottle or whatever, the whole outdoors were spinning, and I ended up throwing up into this bush next to their property and ended up home in my bed at about 8:45 at night on a Friday evening. I can remember my father looking at me, walking into the house. On, you know, it was almost summertime, and he just looked at his watch. I remember him shooting a look at his watch, like, what are you doing home this early? Because that was highly unusual, and I ended up throwing out the outside of the house on the second floor all the way down the siding of the house. And I remember the room spinning, and I kind of vaguely remember, you know, I tell guys all the time, this was probably one of my first serious prayers that I ended up using. And I said, oh, God, you know, if you just get me out of this one, I'll never do this again. And the following evening, I was drinking liquor, tango in a pint at a football game. And it pretty much just kind of rocked along and continually escalated up and down, graduated from high school, ended up involved in drugs showed up before graduation, but ended up getting quickly involved in drugs. You know, it went from drinking.
So in high school, how did high school go? So high school was mostly drinking, drugging.
Yeah, I mean, high school, you know, I spent my senior year, I spent, so when you're at the pool hall, the neighborhood pool hall during school,
yes.
And you get a phone call on the pay phone from the vice principal to come down to his office, you might have a problem, you know. So I'm down there shooting nine ball and hanging around with drug dealers and you know, guys running number. I mean, you know, these are my people. I mean, you know, I got involved in drugs early on, you know, and I upon graduation, that was my kind of. I was also involved in a rock and roll band, you know, roadieing for a rock and roll band, and my whole plan was going to be that I was going to do that, and I was going to, you know, I was going to be a rock and roll. So I can remember telling a friend of mine, I'm going to have. This comes up in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous too. It talks about grandiosity, you know, grandiose thinking. I told my friend, I'm going to have a rock and roll band that is greater than the Rolling Stones. And this was in like 1975, maybe 74. So he looked at me like, yeah, whatever. And so, you know, got involved with drugs and it was really close to being. I was dealing a little bit, but I was very close to going way over the edge. And
what drug were you dealing?
What drugs was I doing?
Was it speed, coke, marijuana?
Marijuana, back in the day, it was, you know, it went from being Mexican, then I went to Colombian, then I went to Thai stick off the West Coast, then I went to, you know, hashish, black hashish, then I went to, speed. Yeah, speed was a big deal early on, and then cocaine. When cocaine, you know, became part of the equation, everything else kind of took a back seat. Except for the drinking still persisted, you know. And so I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm collecting unemployment. It's 1978. It's 2 years after graduation. I'm dealing out of my parents' house, and I'm doing literally nothing. And one day on a Saturday morning, I get a knock at my bedroom door, woke me up at, you know, like 11:30 in the morning. And my father says, we're going for a ride. So that day I joined the United States Navy. The following week I spent three hours in the Syracuse AFI station to get a seat in San Diego. I wanted to go to California. My whole mindset on this was, okay, you're going to send me to the military. I'm going to go and I'm going to party in some of the finest bars and cities in the world, which is exactly what I did. That kind of panned out. So I end up in the Navy, and you know, it's wide open. You know, it's 78 to 82. It's wide, absolutely just wide open. You know, I got busted down for possession. I was dealing. We had set up a system where we were dealing small packets of marijuana on the ship. I took some really huge risks. Basically, my mindset was I wanted to do everything for free. I'm gonna sell it to you so I could do mine for free. And I know that never ends up working out, but it never, you know, it was a controlled environment, so it couldn't really get out of hand that much in terms of the usage. But it lasted a whole cruise, and they couldn't figure out where it was coming from. And when I got popped, they suspected it was me that was involved in it, but they could never really prove it. You know, and I just looked at it like I was just beating the system. You know, you knock me down and get back up. I mean, I'm invincible at this point. You know, and I get out of the Navy, and I remember the following day I got out of the Navy, I went and rented a car. I had a bunch of money. I went and rented a car, and I went to the liquor store, and I bought some really high-dollar rum and all the makings for pina coladas, because I had learned in the bar in Nassau, the Bahamas, when we were on leave, right before I got out, when we came back to Charleston, from this bartender that worked in the casino, he gave me a recipe for the best pina colada in the world, and I had it. And I came home and I made pina coladas for everybody for like a week. You know, that was the way that's the way I thought. You know, I was doing something really great. And this is 1982, the fall of 1982, and within, I'm thinking within a year, I had two DUIs. Now I'm starting to have some level of consequence, palpable consequence. But I still, you know, I bounced off of that. You know, my father getting me out of this and getting me out of that with the law enforcement, and I kind of rocked and rolled through that. You know, but at the same time, now it started to take a little bit of a toll mentally on me that, you know, maybe something's not quite right with dude. But you know what? There were times of sobriety, and there's a part in Bill's story where it talks about, you know, he had brief moments of sobriety that renewed his wife's hope. Now, I wasn't married, but it probably renewed my family's hope and people that were close to me, although they never said anything. But I would, there was times when I would stop. You know,
How long did you stop?
I mean, when I got my first DUI, I probably stopped for a couple weeks, and just, you know, the thought was, and I had to go to, that's another part of it, had to go to DUI class, had to go to these classes where probably someone like myself now was standing up there talking about how he got sober, and, you know, and I just thought, yeah, that's for y'all. I mean, that's, you know, that's your problem. That's not my problem. I'm okay. And so I probably two weeks, maybe, you know, possibly, you know, I think the second DUI, I might have stayed sober for a month, maybe. I kind of remember, like, you know, somebody said to me, you can't stop drinking for 40 days, and I said, you see, and I did, okay? And so that kind of reinforced my thinking that I don't have a problem. You know, I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I'm not this guy who wears a trench coat and drinks out of a brown bag down in the Bowery. That was my vision of an alcoholic, okay? That's not me. There was a town drunk. We all knew him. We called him the sheriff. I'm not him. You know, I'm working. I got a car. I'm slick. I mean, you know, please. That's not me. And so that reinforced the idea, if I could quit for 30 days, you know, there's no way I'm an alcoholic if I could quit for 30 days. But as soon as I started drinking again, there was a part, you know, now we're getting into like the mid-80s. I'm in the airlines. I moved to New York City. Now it's on, okay? I'm in New York City. Another what we call geographic change. I'm in New York City.
Oh, sure.
I'm with all these new people. None of them know me. None of them. They don't know me.
the real me, and I'm good with that, you know? And so now I'm starting to ramp up my drinking again, and my fiance came to me and said, she was actually, early on, was supplying all my drinking materials, you know? Cocaine hadn't really entered the equation yet because I had to kind of, like, get acclimated, you know? It was an Italian American family, and they were very, you know, they were very strict about certain things, and I had to kind of be careful what I was doing. And so, you know, there was, I'm not going to get into all that, but, you know, the dynamics were such that I had to kind of figure out who the players were and figure out, you know, how I was going to, you know, fit into all this. And I fit in real quick. And my who was to become my brother-in-law, he was dealing cocaine. So how good is this? So, but what happened is I go to a party one night, well, that one day, and I don't even know why. It could have been a blackout situation. Not really totally sure what really went down. But I kicked this folding metal chair kind of across the backyard, and not completely across, but it was, you know, across, say, 15 feet of this open area, and apparently it almost hit one of the nieces of the guy who was holding this party, you know. And I basically was told in no uncertain terms that I needed to leave, and I wasn't allowed back, you know. Your drinking's out of control. And this guy, he was scared because he said, you're worse than me. And I'm like, you know, whatever. So I, you know, my wife was really scared, and she said, you know, you need to stop. So we poured all the liquor. I mean, I was coming, at this point, I'm coming home from work, you know, I'm working second shift, and I'm coming home from work, and I'm watching Letterman on TV, and I'm drinking myself into a stupor, into basically passing out, drinking Manhattans, you know, I'm probably going through, you know, three or four bottles of vermouth a week, you know, and just that alone. And so we poured it all out, and so I my thought was, well, you know, okay, I'm not going to drink anymore, but, you know, I could still do cocaine. I mean, yeah, that'll be all
right.
Which is what I did, which is exactly what I did, and just about ran the wheels off of it up and through you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I lost it. Up and through the, you know, the late 80s. And my marriage was falling apart. And I really, to be quite honest with you, at that time, I really didn't care. I was looking to get out. I needed to go. So it did go away. You know, there was a separation, and I called one of my brothers who lived in Atlanta, and I visited Atlanta about a year before that. Kind of liked it, kind of reminded me of upstate, you know, it was a lot hotter, but, you know, I was like, yeah, that's good, you know, I'm good. And moved to Atlanta, and ended up getting divorced. And what had, now this was the longest period of not doing anything. So I was, quote unquote, sober, hadn't had any drugs or alcohol for a period of about 4 months. And one day, this friend of a friend said, let's go get something to eat. And we end up at a restaurant, and he said, oh, you don't drink? And I was like, no. And he kind of knew that, because I said that, no, I don't drink. And, you know, he's drinking, and then an hour into this thing, you know, he's like, come on, man, you can have one, can't you? And I thought, you know, I haven't had a drink in 4 months. I mean, what's one going to hurt? I mean, one ain't going to do nothing. I mean, that's why I was like, yeah, I can have one. So he ordered me a beer, and I drank it. And, you know, like the next morning, when I had spent all my money, wasn't even totally convinced where my car was, woke up and I can remember looking across my bedroom in a half blind look and seeing like this crumpled yellow bunch of stuff. And I remember, oh my God, I got a ticket. And you know, and I kind of went into a funk and I was like, I got to stop. My girlfriend at the time was living with me. She's like, yeah, you need to slow it down. So I was like, yeah, you know, I do. I need to slow it down. And I slowed it down. So there was no more drinking during the week. There was only drinking on Saturdays. And I had to, you know, kind of cut it off early on Sunday. And I just didn't, you know, I worked a 9-to-5 job. And I kind of did that for, oh, I don't know, maybe a week. And, you know, the next thing that thought crossed my mind, again, now this is happening kind of sort of in rapid succession with me, these thoughts, that, you know, look, I can control this. It's not as bad as I think it is. I can, you know, I'm going to be able to do this. I just need to nut up and control it. And I was trying
right.
to control it. And so I say now, you know, here's the thing about what I know now. You know, every time I try to control it, I'm not enjoying it. And every time I'm enjoying it, I'm not controlling it. So it was a huge lie I was telling myself that I could control this because there was just no way I could control it because I was beginning to go almost, not every time, but almost instantaneously from, you know, one drink to oblivion in a short order, you know. And as a matter of fact, it got to the point where that's where I saw oblivion every time I drank. I wasn't drinking because I liked the taste. I was drinking because I liked the effect it produced. To go back to the original time I drank when I was about 7 years old, the effect produced was what I was looking for. And so I could not get enough. You know, there's a saying that gets tossed around in the rooms now these days, you know, one's not enough and a thousand's, you know, or one's too many and a thousand's not enough. So, I mean, that's a problem. But I still didn't see it as a problem. I just saw it as, you know, a little inconvenience, really. I mean, as long as I can continue to do what I'm doing and everybody just kind of leave me alone and I didn't get another DUI, I'd be good. Well, one night, I'm in the car business, and I sold the biggest deal in the dealership's history. Got
wow.
a big fat check. Yeah. Yeah, I got a big fat check. Congratulations, got a big fat check. And don't you know, I got to celebrate. Right? I mean, come on.
Hmm.
So I go across town, me and my girlfriend go across town, meet a friend's large that we constantly drank with to excess. And we're drinking in the bar, and at one point he says, dude, let's go get some cocaine. Now, I hadn't been doing any cocaine for a while, and I was like, really? I didn't know you did cocaine. He's like, oh, yeah, man. And now he's talking about crack cocaine. I didn't really know it until we were getting there, and I was like, yeah, I heard about this stuff. He's like, dude, it is the bomb. I'm like, well, I know cocaine is the bomb, so yeah, let's rock. Now I'm drinking to excess, and I'm doing crack cocaine, and I went to get some gas and came out and took a left-hand turn down a one-way street, and a Georgia State Patrol car was sitting right at the end of the street, and he come rolling right down and put his nose in front of my nose, and I knew I was toast. I just knew it. And I said, you know, I can't believe it. And I didn't blow, and I refused everything. And, you know, they threw me in jail for the weekend, and I got bonded out. And I quit for 30 days. This was the time I quit for 30 days, I think. And I was really seriously thinking I got to do something different. I can't continue on like this. I mean, I'm going to end up killing myself, you know, in a fiery ball of fire, which actually at this point in time, didn't seem to be like such a bad option, to be quite honest with you. You know, I was like, if that happens, I just, you know, I'll just go out in a ball of flames by myself. I don't want anybody in the car, and I don't want to hit anybody and ruin anybody's property, you know. And so, But that didn't happen. Within the 31st day, it was time to celebrate. You know, I had not done any dope, and I had not had anything to drink for 30 days, and I celebrated on the 31st day, and it was this. We're in the mid 90s, and I just was drinking all the time. To be quite honest with you, the crack cocaine scared me so bad that I backed away from that. But I started snorting cocaine again a little bit, you know. But I was drinking constantly. Now I was at the bar after work. I was there. I was shutting it down every night. Coming home to my dinner in the microwave, all dried out. My girlfriend pissed off at me. To be honest with you, I didn't really care. I was missing work. It started to affect my work. I was letting things go that I otherwise would have taken care of financially, and for the drink. And I didn't see it as being a problem. I just saw it as being, again, it was an inconvenience. I need to make more money. If I make more money, I'll be able to do this. And I didn't realize that every time I made more money, it just went right in the bottle. I mean, that's what was going on. And one night, this guy who I would have considered to be a full-blown alcoholic turned to me and said, "Dude, you're out of control," which kind of pissed me off, to be honest with you. I looked at him. I was like, "Whatever," I said, "You're drunk, dude. What are you talking about?" But that kind of sat in the back of my mind, I could kind of feel the train coming. The train's coming down the track. I'm really seriously hoping I don't spend any more time in jail. I'm not interested in that, but I could feel it coming. And after a full-blown weekend of drinking, I'm sitting in my living room at like 1:30 in the afternoon, hungover, barely could eat anything for lunch, watching Hitler's Henchmen on A&E. If you want
to... Oh, gee. At least there are some cartoons.
If you want to get really depressed, go out and tie one on for, alcoholically tie one on for Bender for a week, a weekend, and then, sit and watch that, both episodes. And the phone rings. And it's my brother, who, we weren't estranged, but it was like, we didn't talk all that much, maybe twice a month. So for him to call, it was a little unusual, out of the blue on a Sunday afternoon, like mid-October. And he's like, "Hey, what's going on?" And I was like, "Oh, not much." And he could just tell by my voice that I was hungover. I mean, he knew it. I was like, "Yeah, not much. Just sitting here watching TV." He said, "Yeah, what do you got going today?" I was like, "Oh, not much. I'm, like I said, I'm just kind of, what'd you do this weekend?" I was like, "Oh, not much." He knew. He said, "Well, I wanted to talk to you about something." I'm like, "Okay, come on over." He goes, "No, let's just meet over, So we pick a place and we meet at this restaurant that's about halfway between him and me. And he said, "When can you be there?" And I said, "Give me about an hour." And he knew, because he's like, "I could have been there in 15 minutes, and I knew you weren't going to be there." And I'm in the shower, taking a shower, and I distinctly can remember thinking, he's going to tell me that I'm drinking too much. He's going to take away my fun. Now, that thought went back, and I had skipped over my first intervention in upstate New York in 1988 with my first wife and my family. I kind of forgot about that, but I had this. So this was my second intervention I'd been ready to go to. But, I thought, well, whatever, we'll see how it goes. Maybe I'm wrong. And driving down to this restaurant, this is what flew out of my mouth. "Okay, God. If this is it, so be it." And I pulled into this restaurant and sat there and started talking to him about his life and up and what was going on with him and how he's hitting the golf ball and this and that and the other. And he stops me. He's like, you know, we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about you. You're drinking too much. And I was like, no, I'm not. He says, yeah, you are. I said, no, I'm not. He says, yeah, you are. You know, he says, every time I call you, you're hungover or you're drunk. And, you know, you tell me you're at the bar all the time. And then when you're not at the bar, you're home and you're drinking. I'm like, yeah, but, you know, I'm not drinking too much. He goes, well, how much do you drink a day? So I go, well, you know, probably like 6 or 8 beers a day. He sits back in his chair and he goes, dude, that's way over the top. And I go, oops. Because I'm thinking, you know, he's my brother. He drinks somewhat like me. But I was lying, completely lying. You know, my 6 to 8 beers was more like maybe a case a day, okay, minimal. And a little bit of vodka could go with it. So I knew I had a problem. So I kind of committed to doing something about it. And he's like, you know, what about AA and this and that and the other? And I've kind of heard some AA before, and I've been in these – I had to go to an AA meeting when I had to go to satisfy some DUI court thing, you know, and, you know, I knew it wasn't for me, and I was like, oh, boy, you know, and I talked to my mom, and she's like, you know, what about AA, and I'm like, and all I could think about was this guy in Canal Street, you know, and I'm not that guy, but, you know, okay, all right, I'll do it. And so I kind of went online and checked out where the best meeting was going to be, where I was going to, you know, be able to, it was going to fit perfectly into my schedule and all this kind of stuff. And I picked one, and I did my first trip to an AA meeting was a clubhouse in Atlanta, and it actually turned out to be a drive-by. Have you ever done a drive-by? It was a drive-by.
Oh, sure, yeah. You just want to see what it looks like from the outside, but you don't really want to go in.
Well, no, I drove up, and there's all these people outside, you know, men and women, like, you know, varying ages and, you know, hugging each other and laughing and drinking coffee or whatever they're drinking, and I'm like, no way. There's no way I'm doing this. Uh-uh. And I just drove right in one side of the parking lot and out the other side. And I didn't go back for a week and drank in the interim. And now I start doing these online meetings. Figure, well, I'll go online and I'll start looking and see what's going on. And I get in this online meeting and become friendly with some of these people and kind of a regular and stuff. And I'm not drinking, and I'm just, you know, all I can think about is drinking. You know, that's all I can think about. I gotta drink, but I can't. You know, I know what'll happen if I don't, if I do. And, so I kind of left out some big chunks of my story, but there was a point in time when I had gotten sober prior to this. When I first moved to Atlanta, I told my mother that I was going to get sober, and that was when I got my first big book at a basement church meeting. These guys said, you need to get a big book, you know. And I opened that thing up, and I read – I remember opening up to page one, because, I mean, that's what you do. When you read a book, you open it up to page one, and I kind of glanced to the left, and I saw this thing on the top said the doctor's opinion, and I was like, wow, that's impressive. They got a doctor with an opinion on this? Holy cow. And I flipped over and started reading the doctor's opinion, but it kind of, you know, he uses a lot of big words and stuff, and it just kind of didn't make too much sense to me because I didn't read that much of it, and I kind of flipped back over to page one, which was Bill's story, and I knew a little bit about Bill, and I also read his story, and I couldn't put it down. I mean, it was like, he was just telling my story, you know? And I read the book, I couldn't put the book down. I read it up to, like, page 127, which is, like, in the middle of the family afterward, and I probably got, you know, some of my resentments were just, like, you know, just reeling their ugly heads, and I was mad at one of my family members, and I shut the book up and put it up on the shelf, and that's where it sat for 7 years. And so now fast forward, now I'm entertaining going back into AA. And so when I had started drinking again, I went somewhere where nobody knew where I was, who I was. And I can distinctly remember the thought process behind it was, you can have one, you better not have one. You know what's going to happen if you have one. And I said, I can do this. And so now I'm going back. I'm doing online meetings anyway, and I drank again, and then I kind of, they come into an online meeting, and one night this girl, her name was Maggie Van Cleve, and she was from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She was, I was interested in her because she was an ordained minister, you know. Not just because she was a female, but, you know, I clearly know that God knew exactly what he was doing by putting this female in my path, okay? She was a fairly attractive girl from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She was ordained, and I started kind of, so I'm going to start toying with her about religion. I'm like, so, yeah, what's up with the sage stuff, you know? And she's like, well, you know, this, that, you know, it didn't pop me, but now I'm like, I did my first meeting. I ended up, she's like, you need to go to face-to-face meetings. And I went to my first meeting, and so my sobriety date is November 13th, 1999. And I haven't had a drink since.
Wow. Can you hold on for a second? We got a caller. Would you like to take a call?
Absolutely.
Hold on. Let's see what we got. Hello, Koala, you're on the air. Who is this?
This is Charles.
Hey, John, how are you?
Good. I seen you posted on Facebook that there was a meeting, so I called in to see what you guys were all about. I don't know what's going on.
Oh, well, it's we're doing an interview to Kurt P. He's in recovery, and he was telling his story. So I thought maybe perhaps you might have heard some of the story and you had a question for him.
No, this is actually my first time calling in, so I don't actually know what's going on.
All right.
Where did you see the link, guy? Where did you see the link?
I seen it on Facebook.
Oh, okay.
Excellent. Yeah, we do the this is the live section of the show. We interview someone, but the lines are open. So if you had a question about recovery or something about the show, otherwise you could just listen in and hopefully you'll get something out of it.
Okay. What time do you guys have meetings? What day
well,
and time
it's,
do you
it's
guys
not,
have meetings?
It's not a meeting format. This is a radio show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you look, that's, and I know they have them. I haven't done any of them, but I know some are available where they have online meetings. You just Google it, online meetings, and they can direct you for times and things like that. They Skype it and all that. But this isn't an online meeting. It's a radio show. We do interviews. And usually if somebody will call in, they'll have a question about something they heard from the guest trying to clarify something about his recovery or his sobriety or something.
Okay.
All righty.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in. Bye.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Go ahead, Kurt. You were saying?
So, I think I was, I got my sobriety date November 13th, 1999, and I got a sponsor right away. The only thing I can really kind of remember about the meeting, really, my takeaway was two things. We suggest you get a sponsor, and then in the preamble, when they read the preamble, typically in a meeting, they talk about the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I remember thinking about that, thinking, yeah, I think I got that, you know. I really do, although that would come to bear in the months to follow. And I would understand what that really means. So I got a sponsor right away, you know, and he was kind of a, you know, he actually, the meeting, the first meeting I went to, you know, he was a discussion leader, and, you know, he was much older than me, which I thought was a good thing, but we had similarities in our story. You know, he was in the music business in California, and, you know, cocaine, and, you know, he was a little bit more involved in drugs than drink, but we had a lot of things in common. So I, you know, one of them snatched him right away, and so, you know.
So you found him. You went get it. You heard some. He said something. His story, that you felt a connection with this guy, and you went up to him and said, "Will you be my sponsor?"
Absolutely. And I remember him. What he said to me was, he looked up at me, and he said, "This is your first." This is your first, because they asked, in the meetings in Atlanta, they asked, you know, if you're at your first meeting. And so it wasn't truly my first meeting, so I didn't raise my hand. But, and I actually, you know, kind of didn't even pick up a white chip because I'd already picked one up in another meeting. So I didn't, you know, but he knew that he had never seen me before. So he's like, "This is your first meeting, or, you know, first time here?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "I sponsor a lot of guys, so I hope you're serious." And I go, "I'm serious. What do you want me to do?" And he goes, "Just come back tomorrow. Just don't drink tonight. Come back tomorrow." This guy was kind of old school. He had been sponsored by old school AA, and that was kind of the message that, you know, hung, you know, preliminary or you know, primarily that message is, it works for a period of time. It works. You know, you cannot drink and attend meetings and hear a message of, you know, what we call a message of I lost my train of thought, but, you know, you hear a message of hope, and you know, that's all good, but there's going to come a time when you're going to have to do stuff, which ends up being what, you know, what you read and how it works of doing the 12-step work. Well, you know, so I'm rocking with this guy. You know, he got me, and I'll get specific with it. You know, he came from a group of people that did a lot of writing. So I wrote out the first half of my first step. I wrote out the second half of my first step. I wrote out the first half of my second step. I wrote out the second half of my second step. And then we kneeled down and did the third step prayer, and he handed me a legal pad and put some lines on it, just like they suggest in the big book, and wrote some words up on top and said, "Okay, now you got to write out your fourth step. Have at it." No real direction.
On your knees? I like that. I like that. Hey, you got to write your whole fourth step on your knees. That'll cut it down.
No.
Carol? That's not a bad idea, huh? Get them on your knees.
Yeah.
Here's a legal pad. Write out your fourth step. When you can't stand it anymore, you're done.
Yeah.
That'll
so
get it.
I remember writing a few things down, you know? I mean, I was at his house. He went into his office, and it was like, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday or something like that, you know. And so, you know, I had better things to do, and, you know, certainly didn't have no desire to do this. And so I wrote out a few things, and I'm like, "Hey, you know, I gotta get going," you know. And he's like, okay, buddy." So we kind of rolled that way for a while, you know. And he was just, you know, he didn't push me, you know. The topic of willingness and, you know, the topic of, you know, when you're ready and, you know, all these types of things, I grabbed onto those, and I was just like, you know, when I'm ready, I'll be ready. And, you know, probably at the same time, though, this friend of mine came up to me. I probably had about 30 days. And he came up to me, he goes, "You want to go to a CA meeting?" I go, "What's that?" He goes, "Cocaine Anonymous." And I go, "Dude, they got meetings too?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah." He goes, "Come on. So we got to go to this Cocaine Anonymous meeting." And I heard a completely, entirely entirely different message than I had been hearing, for the most part, in this meeting. And what these guys and gals were talking about was, you know, they were drilling down on the problem, the solution, and the practical program of action, which they said was all in the first 164 pages of the big book. And I'm like, what do they mean? And so eventually I asked the question, well, you know, I asked somebody, I was like, you know, what do I do? And they go, you need to get a book study. You know, we have these book studies. You know, we have a book study. This group sponsors a book study on Wednesday night right here at this church, which is an open environment, men and women, you know. Suggest you come to that meeting. That's a good place to start, which is exactly what I did. And I walked in there, and the guy that was leading this meeting ended up being my next sponsor. I didn't know it at the time, but that's the way it ended up being. And we start reading from the beginning of the book, which they said was the blank page. And they said, this is what you know about recovery. You don't know anything. If you don't know anything, you need to learn. And this is a textbook. And we went through the fours and the preface and the fours and then into the doctor's opinion. And the first time that I really realized how much of a problem I really had. Now, at this point, I'm about 45 days sober, and we're reading in the doctor's opinion. And we're reading, and they told me that, you know, I had a highlighter and a pen, and they said, make notes. And we're reading, and we read a paragraph, and now this guy is describing and defining words and sentences within paragraphs and paragraphs within the scope of the chapter. And we're defining, and he described what we just read, and it was not even remotely close to anything that I had thought about. I mean, it was so far away, I was just like, wow, I got a problem. It was when I realized I had a problem. I need help, you know? And so at that point is when I kind of gravitated over and I kind of started buddying up with some guys, and I ended up in a men's book site, just men. And they said to me, we're going to go through the big book from the blank page, page 164, and these steps are all going to show up in here, and we're going to do them like they suggest we do them. There's going to be directions to do them all, and we're going to do them as they're directed to do. And so I was like, okay, I can do that. Even though in the back of my mind I'm thinking, this ain't going to work. This is crap. It's not going to work, you know. Although there were people in there that had already done it that were saying, yeah, it worked for me. So what kept ringing in my ear was this part in the book where they say, so, you know, we realized there was nothing left for us to do but to pick up the simple kit of tools laid at our feet. And so when we had gone through that part was, they said the simple kit of tools is the book, and more specifically, the 12 steps. And so I kind of knew that these guys weren't blowing smoke, you know. I mean, early on, I kind of felt like there was a meeting after the meeting where these people were drinking and doing dope and all this kind of stuff, but that had kind of gone away from me. That was kind of a joke, you know. I was like, really, I can't, that's not happening. Maybe for some people it might be, but for the core group, no. These people are serious about this. So the desire to stop became, you mean really, like completely stop? And that's when it hit me. This is before getting into any of the specifics of the doctor's opinion and why we drank and how we try to control it, and the sense of ease and comfort, and the phenomenon of craving, and the obsession, and all this stuff. Before getting any information on any of that, I knew that every time I stopped, I stopped hundreds of times. The problem was that I had never stayed stopped. There was always this. There was what the book describes as this trivial excuse for taking the first drink, and so the old timers will say, put the plug in the jug and keep coming back. And that's the strategy behind that. That's the message behind that. And eventually you'll come back, and eventually, you know, like the book described, you'll get beaten into a state of reasonableness so much so that you'll decide you're going to do something different. Okay? Well, I'm in this men's book study, and I'm cranking along. I've got about 7 months, and we're in the middle of our four steps. And I'm telling everybody I'm in the middle of my four steps. And I hadn't written anything. I had been given I had been given the problem. I had a fairly clear understanding of the problem, you know, that I suffer from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which is a mental obsession and a physical allergy. Once, you know, the definition, the final definition they give us, in, you know, of the real alcoholic is this. If, when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if while drinking you have a little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic, and if that be the case, you suffer from a spiritual experience, or, excuse me, you suffer from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I kind of had that, and it put me in a state of fear, complete and total fear. God was in the equation, big time for me. But at the same time, I was in fear of disclosing the truth about, you know, the real truth about myself. I just didn't want to do it, let alone share it with somebody else. So it got me to the point of being what's called the jumping-off point. Either God is or he isn't. Either I am or I'm not an alcoholic. What's my choice to be? And, you know, I'm left with, you know, I'm left with some choices, too, basically, they tell us. Go on to the bitter end, blotting out my miserable existence as best I can, or accept spiritual help. And I'm, you know, for an alcoholic, that's kind of like, you know, okay, let me, can I get back to you on that? I mean, you know, I need to think about that really seriously. I mean, I don't know if I need to do this deal and turn, I mean, okay, I don't know how powerless I really am, you know, but, you know I need to do something different. And right now, you know, the pink cloud is coming on. You know, I knew I was going to drink it. I knew it. I flat out knew it. And I had done what the book calls the desperate experiment of the first drink. I had done it. And I was very clear about it the last time I drank. It was that time where I sat in the bar where nobody knew I was, and I, you know, I'm going to have one, and I heard, you better not, and I did. And as soon as I drank, you know, that sense of ease and comfort came at once, okay? And so, you know, I'm saying, you know, I better not drink, but my body's going, give me more. And I don't, as an alcoholic, win that battle, ever. But, you know, knowing all that, having all that knowledge, and having God on my side only gave me two parts of the puzzle, okay? Because what I said earlier was that, you know, the book describes the problem, the solution, which I had. I had a definite understanding of the problem, and I had God on my side. But I had no practical program of action. I hadn't done anything, okay? Really, truthfully, I had done, you know, I'd said a prayer, I had attended some meetings, I had a sponsor, I had a good sponsor, you know. I was rocking it, okay. I actually was sponsoring guys and they didn't even ask me to. I mean, you know, I was doing that program too, you know. And so, but I knew that I was, if I didn't, you know, they even say in the book, if we don't take this critical step, we're probably going to drink again, you know. And that didn't even really, like, you know, convince me, okay? You know, back in the third step, you know, being convinced of what you read and how it worked, of the ABCs, you know, I probably wasn't convinced. I needed more convincing. And so I was in between a rock and a hard place, seriously.
You know,
and I knew
let
that.
Let me tell you, people who are not in the recovery, and when they hear that you're not convinced yet, they don't get it. They figure, what is it going to take with this guy? Everything but a mountain has fell on him, and he's not convinced yet. That's the cunning, the baffling and powerful aspect of alcohol.
Right. Well, what the book defines that as is those are people, that's frothy emotional appeal, okay? Frothy emotional appeal, it seldom suffices. And they say that that's coming from people from that are ignorant to what's really going on because they're not alcoholics. they don't understand.
Right.
They don't understand. Most people, the average individual, will have a couple of cocktails and go home. You know, I mean, I can remember drinking. I remember there was this guy that came in the bar two or three times a week. He was a Boston Red Sox fan. I'm a Yankees fan. We used to kind of go at it a little bit, right? And he was an accountant, and he'd come in with a suit and tie, and he'd take his sport coat off or his suit jacket off, and he'd loosen his tie, and he'd order up a black and tan and, like, a Macallan 18, top-shelf stuff. And he'd sit there, and he'd order up another beer, never order up another shot. But he wouldn't finish his Macallan, and he would probably not finish the second beer, and he'd go home to his wife and kids and for dinner. Every time he came into the bar, that's what this guy did. And he would leave sometimes those drinks would sit down at the bar. And I'd be looking down, I'd be like, give me that stuff. I'll finish it.
I'm going to drink that. If he leaves again, I'm drinking that. That's a crime. There's children in Bangladesh that are starving to death, and he's leaving that expensive whiskey on the bar.
Exactly.
That's unconscionable.
And I'm like, so that's my example for guys that you know, I say, that's my example of someone who was non-alcoholic. This guy didn't drink for, you know, he drank because he liked the taste. My sponsor, his example of that is, he first was taken through the big book and got into this debate about effect, you know. And so his sponsor said to him, okay, so what's your favorite non-alcoholic beverage? And he's like, well, that's easy, you know, those Cokes in like the 7-ounce bottles, you know, kind of hot day,
right.
The water's dripping off the side of those things. You drink that. He goes, okay, so when was the last time you sat down and drank a case of those? And he goes, I've never had it. He goes, exactly. You're not drinking. We don't drink because we like, it may taste good, okay? That may be true, but that's not why we're drinking. We're not drinking because it tastes good. We're drinking because there's an effect produced. And, you know, That's what we're looking for. That part in the book comes up in the doctor's opinion, where he says that we were chasing that effect, and it was never there. The effect that I had when I was 14 and a half years old, where I drank 5.5 beers in 1974-75, and I puked my guts out and went home at 8:45 in the evening, okay, that effect was what I was chasing for 28 years, and I never achieved.
Wow. We're going to have to speed it up, Kurt. We got about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, so, the book talks about that alcohol was the great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness.
Yeah.
So I knew that I could not do this, and I needed to do something different. I ended up, you know, moving through the steps, and I did the fourth step and the fifth step and two back-to-back. Well, I did a fourth step, and then I did a fifth step and two back-to-back weekends. And in the second sitting of my fifth step, this guy who did my fifth step said to me, so who are you working with? And I'm like, well, man, you know I'm working at Home Depot. And he goes, no, dude, who are you working? Don't tell me you're not sponsoring anything. He knew I wasn't. He goes, you need to start raising your hand, and you need to start getting some people to work with. And I was like, how do I raise your hand? When they ask for any AA-related announcements, raise your hand and tell them you're going to do a book study. And so now I'm in my eighth step, my ninth step. The following Monday, I'm basically in my ninth step, starting amends. I had done my eighth step list. I'm starting to start making amends. I got a plan for that. And basically I'm in what we call, we're still moving through the book, and I'm basically in my 10, 11, and 12th step, which are the steps that we call, you know, doing 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis, which comprises all previous nine steps. And so,
right. Step,
I raised
let me
my
give you this.
And I was scared, and I didn't know what I was going to say. And I
let
asked,
me give you
and
this.
Said, I'm gonna...
Kurt, let me give you this. Step 10 is steps 4 through 9 in a single package taken in the present.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I started a book study, and basically have not stopped doing that. And you know, I'll be picking up 15 years in November. I mean, I couldn't, you know, when, here's the thing, when you sponsor somebody taking through the step, through the book and through the steps, and they get it, and they're sober and their life changes, that's cool. That's pretty good stuff. But when one of their guys comes up and taps you on the shoulder after a meeting one night and says, introduces himself and says, you know, you took my sponsor through the steps, and I'm taking some guy through the steps now, and introduces that guy to you, and this guy's got kind of a smile on his face, he reminded me of me when I was first coming up, you know, that's when it really gets good. So there's a part of the book that talks about this mushrooming process, you know. So I've attended a ton of meetings in the southeast, and most prominently Atlanta market. I'm now in San Antonio. It's a new place for me. I'm pretty excited about it. I'm starting to attend meetings. I'm even, you know, thinking that I may start a meeting of my own in some fashion. I'm not really sure totally about that yet, but I've done that before, so I can do it again. I mean, I can, you know, and my helping others, which is the 12th step, you know, by helping others, it keeps us sober. I mean, that's how it works. That's really how it works. I give it away to keep it. God is a, you know, the God piece is instrumental in my life. I'm involved in my church. That's new to me, too. New church.
Oh, good. You know what I was going to suggest to you? Maybe do a big book study. You seem like you're perfect for it. You know, just raise your hand where you're at and say, look, I got some experience, and I'd like to do a big book study here. You got a slot for me.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
And then from there, then if it doesn't seem to gel at the end of that study, you say, okay, look, I'm going to grab a coffee pot, and I'm going down the road. See ya.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's kind of how it sounds. Yeah. So I'm, you know, I'm eternally grateful to God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps in the big book, the way that's written, divinely inspired, we think, and you know, all the people that have been instrumental in, you know, helping me, you know, get and stay sober. I don't consider myself to be in, you know, I'm in recovery, but I do not describe myself as a recovering alcoholic. I am a recovered alcoholic. I have recovered. There's a promise in the big book that says this.
From a hopeless state of mind and body, yeah?
That's right. One of the first or second meetings that I was at the CA meeting, the guy who ends up doing my fifth step was talking to this guy after the meeting, and he said this, and I had never heard it, and I've been coming to meetings for 30 days at that point, sometimes multiple meetings. And he said to this guy, look, if you go through the big book and you do the steps in order as they're designed to be done, specifically as they're instructed to be done, your life will become infinitely better than it is right now. I was jaw dropped. I couldn't believe it. I was like, he just told him his life is going to become infinitely better by doing this big book thing. I better get on the stick. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And, you know, I do that to guys all the time. I tell them the same thing because it's true. It's absolutely true. Here's the thing.
1 minute. We got a minute to go, so, yeah. Harold, you got any last words?
Well, I think this has been a great program, and working the steps is the key to everything. Getting a sponsor, and then eventually getting a sponsee. Thanks for being on.
Oh, you're welcome. No problem.
Well, Kurt, yeah, thank you so much for coming in last minute like that. You were a lifesaver. You got a great program. I think you're going to be really a godsend there in San Antonio. They need a guy like you. And, you know, I have people call me and say they're discouraged because of one thing or another, the personalities, or they've been in too long. I call it restless laurelitis, and they don't know what to do. And you know what I tell them? I says, you know, one man can make a difference. Be that change. Don't worry so much what's wrong.
Just start going to do what's right. So remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.